From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Can more American soldiers stop the violence in Baghdad? Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. At the White House today, President Bush and Iraq's Prime Minister al-Maliki said more U.S. troops will be sent to Baghdad from other parts of the country. On To the Point, we'll hear about the challenges of dealing with Iraqi security forces infused with sectarian militias. Also today, as Secretary of State Rice moved on to Rome from Jerusalem, Israel renewed its heavy bombing of Beirut. What are the prospects for Rice's plan to simultaneously call a ceasefire, disarm Hezbollah, and establish an international force in southern Lebanon? On Reporter's Notebook later on, should Congress be able to sue the president in federal court? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Mormon Alney back with To the Point. After Condoleezza Rice met with Israeli and Palestinian leaders today, Beirut was hit by more heavy Israeli bombing. On To the Point, we'll look at the Secretary of State's plan for an international force in southern Lebanon and what her talks have accomplished so far. On Reporter's Notebook, a Republican senator is challenging President Bush's practice of saying he might not obey new laws, even though he's signing them. Should the federal courts resolve the issue? First, this news update. President Bush and Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki met today at the White House. Despite 6 weeks of al-Maliki's security crackdown in Baghdad, widespread violence continues. President Bush said flexibility is needed to deal with changing conditions.
Obviously, the violence in Baghdad is still terrible, and therefore there needs to be more troops. In other words, the commander said, what more can we do? How best to address the conditions on the ground, and they have recommended, as a result of working with the Prime Minister, based upon his recommendation, that we increase the number of U.S. troops in Baghdad alongside of Iraqi troops, and we're going to do that.
Once again, that means troops in Baghdad from the rest of the country, not a total increase in the Americans' soldiers who are in that country. For his part, Prime Minister al-Maliki said his unity government will also bring help to Baghdad from other parts of the country. Peter Baker is White House reporter for The Washington Post, and thanks, Peter, for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Is this what Mr. al-Maliki wanted to hear?
Well, I think this is in the works leading up to this, obviously, but they papered over a lot of the differences that these two leaders have about the approach to Iraq, and, of course, there are differences over what's happening elsewhere in the Middle East, particularly in Lebanon right now. I was very struck by the tone, and I think the clip you played captures it a little bit, sort of the dour tone of the president and the prime minister here for what, and under other circumstances, they had hoped would be a moment of triumph, the first democratically elected chosen prime minister of Iraq coming to the White House for the first time.
What about the idea of having to send more troops into Baghdad when the United States has been talking, hopefully, about reducing the American presence, not just in Baghdad, but the rest of the country?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to augur well for the notion that we're going to see any significant troop withdrawals by the end of the year, or much less by the election in November. The president was asked, how is this plan to secure Baghdad going to be any more successful than all the other ones that have failed so far? And he didn't really have much of an answer other than that, it's important to be resolute in the face of violence and terrorism.
Talking with Peter Baker, the White House reporter for The Washington Post, what you mentioned papering over differences, what about Lebanon?
Well, the president, of course, says he is for a sustainable ceasefire. By that, he means not simply just coming in and stopping the fighting right now, but something that would actually involve addressing what he calls the root causes. Prime Minister Maliki, who's been very critical of Israel, said he was simply for an immediate ceasefire, period. And that's the most they said on this. Prime Minister Maliki did not repeat his criticisms of Israel's conduct on this, and he did not answer a question from an American reporter about his position on Hezbollah, which is very controversial today on Capitol Hill, where he's supposed to speak tomorrow.
When he speaks at the joint session of the House and the Senate, there's some indication that some members may walk out because he's been critical of Israel. Do you expect that to happen? Or you're at the White House, so I may be answering you asking you an unfair question.
Well, there are plenty of fair questions, and I think you'll certainly see some notion of protest on the part of some congressional Democrats. They've made that clear today. They're circulating a letter on the Hill asking Speaker Dennis Hastert to rescind the invitation unless the Prime Minister explains his comments. That doesn't seem likely to happen, but they'll find ways of protesting either by not attending or by making their views known in other ways.
What were some of the other subjects that they touched on and what you referred to as a dour kind of news conference and not the moment of triumph they'd hoped for, although the president did talk a lot about Iraq as a symbol of democracy in the Middle East?
Yeah, but he went through the motions that he, you know, using the language he's used many times before without, I thought, a great deal of emotional investment today. He seemed a little troubled, obviously, by the violence, and that it not only is not going away, it's gotten worse since his secret visit, his surprise visit to Baghdad just a few weeks back. And I think, you know, the things we did not hear at this press conference were some of the issues that Ed Wong has written about in the New York Times, and we've written about issues of amnesty, issues of accountability for American troops, whether they should be tried in Iraqi courts, the issue of militias on the ground and how they can or should be disarmed. They didn't get into this, whether or not what's going on right now is a civil war. Prime Minister Maliki ended the press conference by saying, God willing, there won't be a civil war. Many people would say there already is.
So what appeared to be the relationship between the two men at this time, people whose futures depend very much, of course, both of them, on what happens in Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, the president and his people have gone out of their way since the trip to Baghdad a few weeks back of saying how much the president had confidence in Maliki, how he was the first of the post-Saddam Iraqi leaders that the president really felt had the wherewithal to make go of it. You know, it's a good question how much that confidence is still there. You didn't see a lot of personal body language between the two today that gave you any sense of their relationship. But, you know, it's easy to overread these things.
These are not people who know each other terribly well or have met each other very often, so one would assume they might have some difficulty appearing in public together and knowing exactly how to relate with one another. Peter Baker's White House reporter for The Washington Post. In a moment, we'll hear more about Baghdad. Later, we'll hear more on the efforts to stop the violence in Lebanon on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, President Bush says more American troops will be working with Iraqi security forces within Baghdad, the city now seen as the key to holding Iraq together.
This plan will involve embedding more U.S. military police with Iraqi police units to make them more effective. Prime Minister advised me that to support this plan, he and General Casey have agreed to deploy additional American troops and Iraqi security personnel in Baghdad in the coming weeks. These will come from other areas of the country.
Again, the president at the White House today with the Prime Minister al-Maliki of Iraq. Still with us, Peter Baker at the Washington Post. The president talks about embedding American troops with police units in Baghdad. We've heard an awful lot from Baghdad about the embedding of militias in the police units. You mentioned that just a moment ago. Nothing said about that today. Is there any indication now that the White House has that in mind as it assigns more American troops to get involved with the Iraqi security forces?
It's really not clear what the White House has in mind. You know, the president spoke in very vague terms today of this new strategy, and you know, obviously American troops have been embedded in the past with Iraqi forces, so it's not really clear what's going to be different. He said that the part of the plan would involve taking a particular neighborhood, securing it, and then moving on to other neighborhoods, but it's sort of you know, we haven't really gotten a good explanation of what that means compared to what they have been doing for the last 3 years at this point.
Mentioned a couple of things talked about in advance, but not at the news conference. One, amnesty for some of those Iraqis who are regarded as dissidents, even militant ones. The other was the accountability of U.S. troops. Should they, in fact, be tried in American military courts, or should the Iraqis at least have something to do with the process when U.S. troops are accused of violations of some kind in Iraq? Any indication from the White House as to why those didn't come up?
Well, it's a good question. They may have come up in the private meetings. They did not come up at the public news conference, and one of the things we're still trying to learn is what might have been said about them behind closed doors. Clearly, these are two issues in which the two sides were not going to come to some sort of mutual understanding today. Bush is not going to allow American troops to stand trial in Iraqi courts. That's simply a non-starter in terms of American policy and certainly the political atmosphere in Washington. And obviously, by the same token, he doesn't agree with the idea of amnesty for insurgents who have killed Americans, which is also something that's been quite controversial in the discussion in Washington. And so, you know, what he could agree to that would make Prime Minister Maliki happy is sort of hard to imagine.
So, again, then, Peter Baker at the White House, how much longer is the Prime Minister going to be here? We talked about the address to the joint session of Congress tomorrow. What's going to happen other than that before he goes back to Iraq?
Well, he's going to, as you say, he's going to address Congress tomorrow, and he's going to visit Fort Belvoir in suburban Virginia outside of Washington with the President to meet and thank some U.S. troops for their help and their sacrifice in Iraq. He's also going to go to New York on Thursday before leaving back for home.
So he'll be then at the United Nations.
Yeah, I'm not entirely clear what his New York schedule is, but I think that's right.
All right. Well, Peter Baker, thanks as always for being with us, White House reporter for The Washington Post.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We, of course, will cover the Prime Minister's address to the joint session of Congress tomorrow, and we'll also look at the level of U.S. support for the war in Iraq and its continuance as well. Condoleezza Rice is on her way to Rome, the next stop in her effort to find what she calls a sustainable solution to the latest Middle East crisis. Earlier, she stood at the side of Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who said this about Israel's intentions.
The Israelis determined to carry on the fight against Hezbollah. We'll reach out for them, we'll stop them, and we will not hesitate to take the most severe measures.
After that statement, Secretary Rice left for Rome, and Israel then hit southern Beirut with another very heavy bombardment. Aryeh Maykel is Israel's consul general to New York. Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for joining our program.
Thank you.
Let me ask you this. You must be aware that even Americans who are supportive of Israel are asking why it is necessary to have so much bombing in the city of Beirut, to have done so much to destroy the infrastructure of Lebanon, where leaders are saying today that the country has been set back for 50 years. Why is that necessary?
It's necessary because we had a situation that the terrorist organization Hezbollah was sitting at our border. And every time that Iran and Syria gave the marching orders, they attacked Israel. Now, we learned from this war a couple of things. We learned that, indeed, they did have long-range missiles, maybe 10,000, 13,000 missiles, and that they are ready to use them. Now, nothing would stop them the next time, if there were next time, from adding biological, chemical warheads. This is not a situation that the Jewish state can tolerate. Now, we've been talking to the Lebanese government for at least 6 years now since we left Lebanon, and the UN was talking to them and said, listen, you guys, send down your military to the border, take care of the Hezbollah problem, it's going to destroy you. But to no avail, they were getting their instructions from Syria, and they were not doing it. So now we reached a point that we had no choice. This is the point of no return. If we didn't do it now, we would have a much even worse situation in the future.
The current prime minister, though, does not appear to be getting his instructions from Syria, and it's pretty clear that the Lebanese military is not sufficiently strong to take Hezbollah out by itself. Again, the question becomes, why destroy so much of Lebanon? Is this, as some have called it, collective punishment?
No, we are attacking Hezbollah strongholds, Hezbollah facilities, Hezbollah missile depots, etc., etc. It is true that the current prime minister is not pro-Syrian. He, in fact, reports to Saad Hariri, the son of the slain prime minister that was slain by the killed by the Syrians. On the other hand, the president of Lebanon does report to the Syrians, so they still don't have that thing arranged there. But in any case, we have no problem with the government of Lebanon or with the people of Lebanon. We want to live in peace with them. When we say, send your military down to our border, it means that we trust their military, that they would want to live in peace, let's say like we do with Egypt and Jordan. So, but Hezbollah has to disappear as a threat to the Jewish state. It's as simple as that.
Aryeh Mekel, again, the Consul General of Israel in New York. It's been reported that what Secretary Rice is talking about now is, although vaguely defined, a four-point plan, or at least a four-point plan, return of the kidnapped soldiers, disarmament of Hezbollah, a ceasefire, and then some kind of international military force in southern Lebanon to bolster the Lebanese army. Is Israel behind all four of those things, providing that they occur simultaneously?
We prefer the implementation of UN Resolution 1559, which basically says the disarmament of Hezbollah and sending down the Lebanese military to our borders. However, if the Lebanese government claims that they are too weak, and perhaps they are, we are ready to consider an international force that will be there on a temporary basis until Lebanon can send down its troops. And yes, we also need the return of our kidnapped soldiers. That's another element. So basically, I guess the answer is yes.
What soldiers from which countries would be acceptable as part of an international force?
We want strong countries like the Europeans, perhaps some of the friendly Arab countries such as Egypt, not something like the UN has done. You know, the UN has had a peacekeeping force in Lebanon for a long time. Basically, they were watching what was happening, reporting to New York, and that's about it. They never prevented Hezbollah from doing anything. So that's not the kind of force we want. We want to see Europeans, maybe Egyptians, that will actually take action and really prevent Hezbollah from returning.
We just heard the Prime Minister, Mr. Olmert, say that the most severe measures are going to be used, and one would assume they are being used, particularly given the bombardment again of Beirut today. How long do you, Mr. Ambassador, think this will go on?
Our position is that we have no timetable. It'll go on until we reach our goal. And again, our basic goal is that Hezbollah will no longer be able to send missiles or rockets against Israel. This is our goal. And we have no timetable, and we'll just continue as long as it takes.
Aryeh Mekel, once again, the Consul General of Israel in New York. Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for joining our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Once again, Secretary Rice left Jerusalem just shortly, a short time ago, as we understand it, and is still on her way to Rome as we speak. Carby Leggett is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Carby, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
What's the significance of the fact that just after Secretary Rice left for Rome on what's been described as a diplomatic mission, talking about trying to achieve some kind of ceasefire, albeit a sustainable one, not an immediate one, what's the significance of the fact that Israel almost immediately unleashed what apparently was an enormous bombing assault on Beirut?
Well, I think the significance is that it suggests very strongly that the war could continue for some time. Secretary Rice arrived in Beirut with a pretty clear-cut package that she said could lead to the cessation of hostilities, and you addressed those 4 points earlier. The problem is that in Lebanon and in a growing number of European capitals and virtually across the entire Arab world, what they're looking for is a ceasefire first and then a time period to hash out these issues of disarming Hezbollah and creating an international force to watch the border and even negotiations over the prisoners. So you have a pretty fundamental divide over the sequencing of how to end this war.
What about the relationship between the United States and Israel? Is there any divide there?
It doesn't seem like it.
So in other words, then, the ongoing bombing of Beirut is something that, at least tacitly, the United States has approved of, or has not asked not to happen.
I think so. I think that's the case. There's an interesting dynamic unfolding here as we speak with the ground offensive in southern Lebanon. So far, it's been fairly limited. Israel's been using mostly special forces and small teams to go in and confront Hezbollah guerrillas face to face. Really, the problem is with the level of troops on hand at this point. It doesn't appear likely that Israel's going to be able to sort of root out, as they say, a wide swath of southern Lebanon. And if that doesn't happen, Hezbollah militants are more than likely to continue firing rockets. Today there were more than 50 more fired. A 15-year-old girl was killed in one. So you have a situation where the Israeli offensive, particularly the aerial offensive, continues, and yet the missiles keep flying back at Israel. This creates a scenario where escalation becomes a distinct possibility, and it also raises the stakes for the military by potentially creating an image that it's not making much success on the ground against the militants, but still pressing ahead with a really punishing aerial campaign.
Again, we're talking with Kirby Leggett, who's Jerusalem bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Still with us, Ambassador Arye Maykel, Consul General of Israel in New York. Your response, if you will, to what we just heard, that this war might go on for some time, particularly if it appears that neither the aerial bombing nor the relatively limited ground forces of Israel can take out Hezbollah.
You know, there's a bottom line here. At the end of the day, there are 5.3 million Jews, 40% of the Jewish people, a million of them sitting in shelters now for 12 days. You will realize that Israel is not the kind of country that will allow this kind of scenario to repeat itself. Therefore, and certainly not against a terrorist organization. You know, we fought 67, 73, you know, big armies with a million Arab soldiers, and we prevailed. So certainly this is not the kind of scenario that we will allow to return. This is why we have to destroy Hezbollah's military capabilities, and we are doing it now. And I think they were testing the new Israeli government, and they learned a lesson that you don't mess with us, and Israel will punish you. Now, I think at the long run, the people of Lebanon will appreciate what we've done if we are successful in ridding them of Hezbollah. After all, only maybe half of the Shiites support Hezbollah. The Christians do not. The Sunni Muslims do not. The Druze do not. They are, after all, serving foreign elements, foreign countries, Iran and Syria. So at the end of the day, I think this will bring the whole region to a much better situation than it is now. Unfortunately, there's suffering now for people on both sides. Let's not forget the more than 40 Israelis that were killed, the 1,300 wounded Israelis. All this is unprecedented.
Again, Kirby Leggett, back to you in Jerusalem for the Wall Street Journal. You mentioned escalation. What exactly did you mean by that, and how soon might we see escalation?
Well, it could take a couple different forms. I mean, one possibility is these rockets continue to rain down on Israel, and as the ambassador points out, it's an untenable situation. You have roughly a third of the country displaced. The economy is taking a hit. The Haifa port is shut down. It's not a situation that any country could live with long term. So if that's the case, at what point does the government here decide that really the only option is a full-on ground war to get at all of these missiles? I don't know the answer to that.
All right. Again, we're talking with Kirby Leggett, with the Wall Street Journal, also the Consul General of Israel in New York. We'll come back and finish this conversation with both of them before we proceed on our program talking about the situation in Lebanon. We want to catch up with some other points of view as well. On our reporter's notebook a little bit later, we'll talk about whether the Congress should be able to sue the President of the United States. To the point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Marvin Olney back with To the Point. One more question for the Consul General of Israel, Ambassador Arye Maykel. A moment ago, Kirby Leggett suggested that there might have to be a full-on ground war. You yourself indicated that Hezbollah is very heavily armed with many rockets and apparently very difficult to dislodge. What do you think are the prospects for a full-on ground war?
No, this is not going to happen. We have no interest in invading Lebanon. What we are doing is a limited incursion. We do want to destroy their positions in the south. We are doing it now village by village. Now we are in the village of Bin Jebel, which is sort of their headquarters over there. But we have no interest in invading them. What we may do, in fact, is have some sort of a security belt and keep our forces in southern Lebanon for a while until the international force will arrive, because the international forces may take them a while to get organized. I think we'll have to keep our soldiers there for some time on a temporary basis until the international force arrives, but we don't have an interest in an invasion.
Thank you once again for being with us today.
Anytime.
Arye Meikel, Consul General of Israel in New York. And final question for Karvi Leggett in the Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal. The ambassador says no invasion, and yet perhaps a security belt occupied by Israeli troops. Would that sound to Israelis an awful lot like what happened some years ago and until Ariel Sharon finally withdrew Israeli troops?
Well, I guess that's one of the concerns. I don't understand quite how a security belt fundamentally changes the strategic equation in along that border. Hezbollah operates throughout southern Lebanon, and their missiles, some of their missiles have the ability to reach deep into Israel. So, short of shutting down the missile cells across that southern region, which is about 1,000 square miles or so, I don't see how there's any fundamental change.
It was being reported in the American media not long ago that the United States was giving Israel something like one more week before international opposition became so strong that the attacks would have to continue. It wouldn't sound, Karvi Leggett, very much like that's the case at this point.
I know. It's hard to say what the real planning is. I mean, the U.S. has staked out a position that these are the terms of what a ceasefire will look like, and that effectively imposing those conditions. If they aren't accepted, perhaps the war could go on for weeks or months. People are already saying it's going to be some time before the international peacekeepers can arrive. So in any case, Israel's going to have a security problem on its border, and at least until that point.
Karvi Leggett again, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much to you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Once again, Secretary of State Rice has moved on to Rome for meetings with UN officials, with Europeans, and three moderate Arab states, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt. At the White House today, President Bush had this description of her mission.
Condi goes with the following messages. We support the Sanaa government. We care about the people. We will help to get aid to the people. And that we want a sustainable ceasefire. We don't want something that's, short-term in duration. We want to address the root causes of the violence in the area. And therefore, our mission and our goal is to have a lasting peace, not a temporary peace, but something that lasts.
Familiar words from President Bush at the White House today. Sounds very much, of course, like what Condoleezza Rice has been saying as well. Mark Perry is former reporter for Newsday. He's a one-time advisor to the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. He now co-directs Conflicts Forum, which is an NGO in Beirut. And he spoke today in Washington at the Middle East Institute. That's a think tank with a diversity of viewpoints. And Mark Perry, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
You have been listening, I know, to the Consul General of Israel and to Karvi Leggett, the Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal, saying effectively, Karvi Leggett in so many words, that this war is going to go on for some time. How does it look, do you think, from the point of view of Hezbollah? I know you have some contact with them.
Yes, my organization, Conflicts Forum, has been engaged in a discussion with them over the last 2.5 years on a number of topics. I must say that from Hezbollah's point of view, they're doing quite well. All they need to do here is to survive, to come out of this standing on their feet, and so far they are fighting the Israelis straight up. The bad PR here, the bad public relations here, is coming down increasingly on Israel for what looks like a disproportionate response to the threat they're facing. I don't think there's any question that they feel that there's a threat, and there's no doubt that they have a right as a sovereign nation to respond to it. But the continual showing of pictures on TV of the damage done in Lebanon is certainly bringing pressure to bear on the Israeli government to wrap this up. That said, it could, in fact, as your previous guests have noted, go on for quite some time.
Why do you say that all Hezbollah has to do is survive?
Well, at the outset of this conflict on July 12th, the Israeli Prime Minister said that that his goal was the destruction of Hezbollah and their disarmament. 3 or 4 days later, he started to sing a different tune and say that he thought that perhaps if they could be pushed north of the Litani River so their rockets couldn't reach Israel, that would be acceptable. Now he's walked back from that. Hezbollah can no longer be a threat to Israel, and they're talking about a security barrier, as the ambassador in your previous segment noted. So this is quite a retreat for Israel, and I think that they've learned that this is a very formidable force that they're facing. It's going to take longer than they expected if it can be successful at all. Clearly, Hezbollah cannot be destroyed. It's very doubtful now whether they can be disarmed, and we'll have to wait and see whether they can be really pushed back and neutralized.
How much tolerance, if Hezbollah has that much strength, would it have for an international peacekeeping force of some kind?
Well, this is the problem. Everyone assumes that once Israel calls a ceasefire, the international community agrees to a ceasefire, that there will be a ceasefire. I think it's not likely, but I think it's quite possible that Hezbollah will say, we're not ready for a ceasefire, and we're certainly not ready for an international peacekeeping force or military forces from Europe or other Arab countries on our land in South Lebanon. They look at this as their country, their homes. They don't want foreign soldiers there. It seems to me that the only thing that Hezbollah will accept is an exchange of prisoners, perhaps as a part of a ceasefire. But since no one is talking to Hezbollah at present, no one knows this for sure.
How does Hezbollah explain, if it needs to explain, to those Lebanese who are not supportive of it, mentioned earlier by the ambassador, perhaps the Druze, the Christians, and the Sunni Muslims, why it kidnapped two Israeli soldiers, certainly a provocative act described by Israel, of course, as an act of war, only to bring about this terrible destruction to the whole country? How does Hezbollah justify that?
I think it's going to be difficult. I think Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, is going to have some political difficulties with this inside of Lebanon. On the other hand, I think it's an oversimplification to assume at this point that the Lebanese people have turned against Hezbollah. The bombing campaign that Lebanon has been subjected to has actually increased support for Hezbollah. And I also think that we can't ignore the fact that 4 or 5 months ago, the leader of the Christian movement in Lebanon, Michel Aoun, signed a memorandum of understanding with Hassan Nasrallah, and has been very careful about denouncing him, stands with him against Israeli aggression. So this is a very complicated conflict. It's not as straightforward as it seems, and I don't think that we can assume that the Lebanese people will turn on Hezbollah. They clearly won't.
Talking with Mark Perry again with Conflicts Forum, a nonprofit in the Middle East, trying to bring about an engagement between the West and political Islam. Earlier, the Consul General of Israel suggested that if there were to be an international force, troops might include people from Europe and also countries he referred to as friendly Arab countries. He included Egypt in that number. What do you think are the prospects? Would Hezbollah accept troops from friendly Arab countries as part of the international force?
They might accept Arab soldiers as part of an international force, but I think it would be very difficult for Arab nations to come up with a good composition for that. This is going to have to be a force that is capable of combat operations. It's going to be very different and very difficult for an Egyptian soldier or a Turkish soldier to turn their guns on a fellow Muslim. And no one wants the prospect of an expanded war here between Sunnis and Shias. And it seems to me if we had Egyptian troops in there exchanging fires with Shias, this would cause enormous problems across the region and might actually be a further incendiary to the current problem. So I think that having Arab troops there is probably a non-starter at this point.
One final question. The United States has publicly ruled out the possibility of American troops being involved in any such force. What do you think? Do you think there's any possibility at all that American soldiers might be sent to southern Lebanon?
I keep hearing that the United States has ruled this out, but I think that Israel has ruled it in and has from my information, ask the Americans whether this is possible. This would be very difficult for us, as most of our ground troops right now are either in or on the way to or coming back from Iraq. We simply don't have that many troops available, and we certainly don't want to put any more of our troops in harm's way any more than they are. So it's going to be a difficult, I think this is going to be very, very difficult to find the right mix of troops and to get real volunteers who want to do this. No one is stepping up to the plate.
Again, Mark Perry is with Conflicts Forum. He was in Washington today at the Middle East Institute, and thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Our final guest on this segment of our program, an expert on military affairs, the Middle East, and the world in general, Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow, Arleigh A. Burke Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mr. Cordesman, always good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
Our last guest said that he thinks Hezbollah is doing pretty well at the moment, that all it needs to do is survive, and that it's doing that at the same time that Israel is getting a terrible publicity around the world for the destruction that's being caused in Lebanon. Do you think that Hezbollah is doing pretty well?
Well, it is surviving, and in some ways for Hezbollah, that's a victory. All it has to do to show that it is one of the few forces standing up to Israel is be around when this is over. The question, however, is, on the one hand, standing for something doesn't really help Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shiites, or anyone else. The fact is that Lebanon has suffered terrible damage. It has had a massive humanitarian catastrophe. The bulk of the people who suffered were Shiites. And at the end of it, Hezbollah does not have any particular goals that it can achieve through this. It also has to face now the uncertainty that there will be an international force. And one coupled to very serious pressure on the Lebanese government to step in and do something about Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah may be able to survive that too, but at the end, surviving Israel is, on the one hand, a kind of tactical victory, and on the other hand, leaves no one having won.
It would appear that although apparently rather limited ground forces are making some progress in southern Lebanon, the aerial attack on Hezbollah certainly has not disabled its missiles. 40 or so landed in Israel again today. What if, and I guess we're always talking what ifs in this situation, Hezbollah simply can't be defeated by the Israelis. How is an international force then going to be able to assert itself?
Well, the main thing an international force can do in the area that it occupies is, if there are enough people, ensure that there aren't rockets being launched, that Hezbollah cannot stage operations. But this is a matter of the numbers of people involved, the rules of engagement, the area they have to cover, and the method of Hezbollah attack. If the international force is too far south, the Hezbollah has some very long-range rockets, and it could fire over the international force. If it is a matter of Hezbollah infiltrating people in with a few of these small artillery rockets, one reason they're so hard to stop is they're very small, they use crude launchers, and they're just firing into the area. So this means that the Hezbollah could infiltrate and probably often avoid the international force. If they use sabotage and start attacking the international force, then things get to be even worse. So we can go from one kind of war of attrition against Israel to a more mixed war against the peacekeeping force. And this makes it a very open-ended game. A lot depends on Hezbollah's intentions. A lot depends on how many international peacekeepers there are. A lot depends on how the people in the South feel about all of this, because a great deal depends on whether Hezbollah can hide among the people or are going to be informed on by them.
Again, Anthony Cordesman is at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The New York Times today reports that people in Europe, for example, are all saying, great, let's have an international force. And that everyone then will volunteer to be in charge of the logistics in Cyprus. Mr. Cordesman, if there's to be an international force, what country is going to send soldiers?
Well, we have to find out. But I think before we make those judgments, a little time is needed. You do have countries like France, which have demonstrated that they will take on difficult missions. British forces are tied down. They certainly played this role in the past. You should not, I think, discount the Scandinavian countries in a mission like this. The problem, I think, would be that they would have to accept not only taking casualties, but inflicting them. But these are competent forces. But until people have defined the mission, and particularly defined not only how the Hezbollah will be treated, but what the Lebanese government will do and what the Israeli government will do, the humanitarian content, the role that Lebanese forces will play, a lot of this is very speculative. The forces are out there. The military elements are present in many European countries. But as your previous guest pointed out, everything depends on the various political attitudes people have, and these are complex. And it isn't simply a matter of their background. It's a matter of what they're going to be asked to do.
A moment ago, the Consul General of Israel, Arye Meikle, suggested that the international force might include countries that he referred to as friendly Arabs, and among them he mentioned Egypt. Do you think there's any chance that those countries could send troops to southern Lebanon under these circumstances, given the kind of opposition that they feel, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Jordan, from within their own countries?
Well, I think the answer is certainly, because each of these countries has disciplined forces, and these forces serve the central government, and they're not Islamist. And Egypt certainly has a highly disciplined group of troops, particularly in special forces, commando, and other units that can do this. But again, before we end up with these broad categories, we don't know what the terms of the ceasefire would be. We don't know what the mission would be. We don't know whether the Lebanese government and Lebanese forces will support it. There's a real question about, do you put this in a context where Lebanese Shiites feel protected and that there is a humanitarian effort to help them, which would give an incentive to support the peacekeeping force? And you can't treat the Hezbollah as if it was simply a terrorist movement or a paramilitary one. There is, sooner or later, the need to negotiate, or at least try to negotiate with Hezbollah. And that, I'm afraid, warns you as to how complex this can be.
What do you think will be accomplished in Rome by the Secretary of State? Will she be able to say that she's made specific progress, do you think? Will the mission of the international force finally be defined, or is it too soon for that?
I think it's probably too soon. You might get agreement on broad terms and principles, but to do it now with so many actors involved is, I think, very difficult. And even once you have the mission and you've defined it, you have to remember that you may have volunteers coming in from the outside, that Syria and Iran may agree to one thing or not agree to it and do quite another, that the Lebanese government may agree to things along with elements of the Lebanese forces and not do it. And in 1982, we saw Israel act very unilaterally, and in one case, expose U.S. troops in ways which, in many aspects, contributed to the Marine Corps barracks bombing. This is not something where you get an agreement once, particularly in Rome, and then suddenly you can, from that, automatically have facts on the ground, particularly facts that last for several weeks or several months.
Once again, you said this is an enormously complex situation. Every time you add a new element, we get a sense of just how complicated it is. Thank you, as always, very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow, Arlie A. Burke Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Pennsylvania's Republican Senator Arlen Specter says Congress ought to be able to sue the president in federal court. He's drawn up a bill to make that a reality. It's all about President Bush's practice of signing bills into law with statements saying they might not be constitutional after all. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at kcrw.com, keyword To the Point. You can also podcast the show at kcrw.com.
We're in Alney, back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. President Bush has issued between 750 and 800 so-called signing statements, indicating that new laws might be unconstitutional, and saying that even in the process of signing them. The American Bar Association says that in itself violates the constitutional requirement that presidents either sign a bill, cast a veto, or take no action at all. Charlie Savage first revealed the practice in the pages of the Boston Globe, where he is legal affairs reporter. And Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Stirred up a hornet's nest in Washington, didn't you?
Well, it's certainly starting to get more attention. Initially, there was not a lot of people paying attention to this, so glad to see it.
Is there a pattern to the signing statements? Are some kinds of bills getting signing statements by the president and others not?
Yes, overwhelmingly, the provisions in bills that President Bush has been challenging are laws that would constrain his own power as commander-in-chief or the head of the executive branch. Anytime Congress passes a law saying you can't do this or you must do that, like you can't torture or you can't use U.S. troops to fight combat against rebels in Colombia, or you must give us certain information, he's attaching a signing statement to that clause saying, essentially, this is unconstitutional insofar as it would require me to do something I don't want to do or forbid me from doing something I do want to do.
So you get to the balance of powers in the Constitution between the legislative and executive branches. Now, Senator Spector wants to bring the courts into this. So how's he going to do it?
Senator Spector is floating the idea of passing legislation that would give courts essentially jurisdiction to hear cases like this, where the party suing the president over this would be Congress, because as an institution. Because one of the reasons that this is such a slippery subject is that the kinds of laws that President Bush is challenging are, by and large, not the kinds of laws where you have an individual person who's been victimized by that law and who has standing to sue, and therefore you can get the question before a judge who can say this is legal or this is not legal. You know, who is the individual person who's been damaged if the president does use U.S. troops to fight rebels in Colombia? Senator Spector's idea is Congress is the party that has been damaged by that because it's its power to write the law and decide what the law is that's been violated by these signing statements.
Okay.
But right now you need a law that would let them do that, so it's very complicated.
In the event that the law were to pass the Senate and the Congress, would the president have to sign it?
He would have to sign it. It's possible he could veto it. There's some alternative theories that maybe they could just do it by passing a resolution without presenting it to the president. But right now the idea is do it in the form of a bill, and then we'll see what the White House does with such a bill if Congress does pass it.
Any indication at this point as to whether Senator Spector has a lot of support?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion of signing statements in the Senate, and there's not been so much discussion in the House, which it tends to be a more conservatively controlled body, as the Senate is more centristly controlled. So right now it's still at an early stage.
We're talking to Charlie Savage, who's legal affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. The American Bar Association, as I indicated, has come out against the signing statements. Does it have a lot of clout in the Congress?
Well, it does historically, there's no doubt, and every time they say a judicial candidate is well qualified, everyone who supports that candidate, conservative or liberal, loves to tout that fact. On the other hand, there have been some conservatives who have attacked the American Bar Association for not supporting Republican policies enough, so it's a mixed bag.
You mentioned that the bills involved tend to have provisions that in one way or another constrain presidential power, and you talked about the use of troops and the use of torture as well. What are some other examples of bills that Senator Spector in particular is concerned about?
Well, I mean, we're talking about 750, 800 now provisions in these laws that are, so it's all over the map. They include all kinds of military rules and regulations, tons and tons of places where Congress has required the government to give, the executive branch to give it certain information so that it can perform its oversight duties. Maybe most notoriously, all the oversight provisions that were added to the Patriot Act earlier this year when they reauthorized it. Bush attached signing statements saying he could withhold that information if he chose to. But it also extends to things like you will tell us scientific information that's developed with taxpayer money if we request it right away and uncensored. Bush has said, I can essentially censor that or withhold it if I choose to. Another category that doesn't necessarily have to do with presidential power, sort of the exception to that rule, is affirmative action. Every time Congress has passed a bill for the last 5 years that includes some kind of provision saying, try to steer some of these grants or jobs to, say, you know, minorities or minority-dominant, historically, colleges for grants or anything of that nature, President Bush is attached to the signing statement saying the executive branch is going to interpret this consistent with the protection of individual rights. And as we know from his arguments in this affirmative action cases, he thinks that affirmative action is unconstitutional.
Have past presidents used this device, signing statements?
Yes, very rarely, going back into the 19th century, every now and then. It started to happen more frequently with President Reagan and President Bush the First, and Bill Clinton also used signing statements to challenge some provisions of bills that they were signing into law. What's different overwhelmingly is the frequency. President Bush, now over 800 provisions, he has challenged more laws than all previous presidents in American history combined. So he's really taking this to another level. And in addition to that, the aggression of the claims he's making in them, this sort of unitary executive theory of the Constitution, which says that, in his theory, that the president is beyond the reach of Congress when it comes to the matters of the executive branch and the military matters, is something new as well. Very aggressive and much more frequent.
All right. Well, thank you for being very lucid on a complicated subject. We will watch and see what happens. It's good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
Charlie Savage, legal affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. Today's program produced by Dan Konecki with Cameron Radziner and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at kcrw.com. The keyword is To the Point. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.